Well, the material that we covered yesterday was from chapter 8, not chapter 9. And I thought I was doing chapter 9. That's okay. So we'll do a little review of what we covered yesterday. What are some of the main points that you can recall? Is the way to do what?
Is to build deeper relationship with each other.
Between others?
With each other.
Okay. Related to that point, we'll discuss it today, is the topic of the difference between religious, the term religion, or religious life, and spiritual life. When we get there, we'll discuss it. Do you have something? You had something you wanted to contribute? Huh? I missed it. You didn't get time to review? That's what you're saying? Okay. Well, even just from... without reviewing, looking at you, without looking at your notes, is there something that sticks out in your mind that we talked about that's relevant or interesting or something? Anything? I'll prompt you. Pravishta Karna Randrina. That verse that we ended up with, where the autumn rains and the muddy waters, and yeah, what do you remember about that? Have you experienced that in the autumn? What the autumn rain does to rivers and lakes? Never seen that. Never noticed. Has anyone else noticed that? I've noticed it. After reading the verse, which I was very attracted to, I noticed. It happens like that. And have you experienced or noticed what the effect of hearing is like? Hearing descriptions of Krishna and what that does to the muddied mind? Yeah. And I mentioned there is some contrast in the purport between the bhakti process and the gyan and meditation, dhyan process of yoga. Remember? What I said specifically was, what you said is correct, but what I said specifically was that the gyan and dhyan yoga process processes do not cleanse in the same way that the bhakti process cleanses. In the purport, Prabhupada explains something even more specific. He says that there is some cleansing that takes place, but it's more with gyan and dhyan. But because they are in themselves material, that is, one is interested in self-interest, one's interested in oneself. Selfish interest is still at the heart of the whole thing. Therefore, with some future disturbance, then the whole thing can become muddied again. Then he makes with the bhakti process two distinctions. One of them is that whereas gyan or dhyan work on an individual, bhakti works on many individuals. So he makes the distinction between having some effect on a small body of water and all bodies of water. Bhakti process is very merciful, not only upon oneself, but others as well. It's meant for that purpose, and it works like that. And the second contrast is that the bhakti process doesn't just diminish the disturbances, but it removes permanently the disturbances caused by the mind's agitations by bringing the mind to its to bring the living entity to his original position as Krishna's eternal servant. So that's a fundamental point in our devotion. In accepting devotion and carrying out our activities of devotion is to recognize this is our constitutional position, and finding peacefulness in that constitutional mood of service to the Supreme Lord. Any other points that were discussed?
I discussed about the five most potent things in devotion, sir. And you said that even a little attachment to even one of them, and then one
through
the stage of
Yeah. Spontaneous devotional service, or the stage of bhava. The contrast being specifically, they may be executed in a regulative way. This is important, very, very important in our understanding of Rupa Goswami's teachings of how to come to the bhava and prema stages. We don't have to jump a horse, meaning take up another process to get there. Rather, we follow the regulative process, and by becoming attached to the forms of those regulative vaidhi sadhana bhakti practices, by becoming attached to any one of those processes, the bhava stage or the spontaneous devotional stage will arise. So, very important point, very important point. As our teaching. And then the application of that was, I told the story about Akura. Nice story. There's lots more details to the story. Anything else in relation to that, or any other point?
One point which is sticking to my mind is about devotee association means you have to serve devotees.
Yeah, that was one of the five, correct. That's right.
Our life is mold our life in such a way that it reflects the love of the Dham. So,
yeah. Right.
That means.
And one other important thing. Remember, Krishna in his holy Dham, and by that, and feeling separation from. Being in that place with Krishna in his holy Dham, and that's our spiritual replacer, or you know, substitute, or it has the same effect. In fact, Vipralambha Seva is the teaching of Lord Chaitanya. He himself stayed in Jagannath Puri, although he wanted, was feeling great separation from Vrindavan. Something else about residing, making our place such a sacred place, residing in a sacred place. I mentioned that where the deity is being, where all the activities are going on, the place itself becomes. And Prabhupada said that several times. I heard it three times in New York. This temple's not in New York. This temple's not in Brooklyn. This temple's not in New York. But it's in Vaikuntha. But it turns out he said that at other places also. And he meant it. When Prabhupada was establishing the articles of incorporation for ISKCON, like the legal document, one of the purposes is establishing places of pilgrimage of Krishna. And you can't do that unless you understand that where the worship of the deity and the life of the persons taking part, that's Vaikuntha. That's a place of pilgrimage. And it acts like that upon the individuals. Prabhupada would ask sometimes, what makes this place any different than the house next door or anything else in the neighborhood? Why do we call this a temple and that a house? Same explanation. It's the same mortar and bricks and cement and whatever materials, steel and wood and tiles, same as the one next door, but we call it a temple. So we call this a place of pilgrimage because, and when we participate in activities in that place of pilgrimage, it should be with appropriate respect for the place, the deity, and the persons serving the deity. This is Vaishnava culture. Anything else? Yeah.
But you mentioned the glorification of the speaker of Bhagavatam and then the cyclic succession, in which that speaker belongs. Is not only a point of culture, but also
not only a point of.
It's not only a symptom of being cultured, but also it's essential because it opens the heart to receive the message.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the heart always remains closed. Mm-hmm. The message won't enter into our heart and penetrate mm-hmm. our consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the first point is not an insignificant point. That is. It's a cultured thing to do. Not an insignificant point. In our modern, whatever you want to call it, civilization, way of life, people aren't cultured and they don't do that. It's not encouraged. It's not, so, but within Vedic culture, it's built within the culture. And if we're not accustomed to that culture, we should develop it. Respect. And respect, it's the fabric of Vaishnava relationships, whether it's those that we're protecting, like protecting women, doesn't mean, it means valuable, respecting, or children, or elderly. Now, the usual fare is there's a lack of worthiness of respect, but that so then we don't feel that we need to be respectful because the object of respect is not respectable. And we have that whole rationale that, I mean, even if we have accepted, well, this is a cultural, this is a proper thing to do, we don't do it. We should do it. It invokes, as with respecting the speaker of the Bhagavatam and the subject matter that they're speaking, it invokes from their side a natural compassion. To downpour their mercy, because here's a recipient that can receive it nicely. But, and when we treat others with respect, it invokes in them the character that deserves that respect. It works that way. It's just natural. It works that way. So as Vaishnavas within this world that's not filled with Vaishnavas, we still act in a respectful manner, at least respecting the super soul within, respecting the soul, although embarrassed by the circumstance, the spirit soul. Okay. So I want to go to chapter 9, but to make a bridge from chapter 8 to chapter 9, I'll just read the Sanskrit again for that text 5. Pravishta karna randrena svanam bhava sarodaham dhunoti shamalam krishnaha salilasya yata sharat. Nice verse. And the verse that follows, Maharaj Parikshit is speaking. He's glorifying the pure devotee who has received those messages and says that their heart becomes so pure that they can never leave the shelter of Krishna. And Prabhupada explains that they're leaving means they become unconditional. And those devotees that are pure in heart, they're subjected to tribulations. In some cases, very severe tribulations. Prahlad Maharaj, Nityananda Prabhu, and on the order of Lord Chaitanya to preach, Prabhupada refers to Lord Jesus Christ. Very severe tribulations. But how did they take it? They didn't fault find those who were giving them tribulation. They remained peaceful. They were just concerned about executing their service, of giving, extending compassion. very exalted character. And this is the result of hearing. Prahlad, because he constantly remembered the Supreme Lord, there was no, from his side, no self-interest. And if there's no self-interest, then you're not frustrated. Oh, they're disrespecting me. Prabhupada says they do not mind what becomes of their lives. They take whatever comes as the Lord's arrangement, because their attachment is taking seriously the instruction that impelled them to extend compassion. It's very, very, it's the term of the language, and it's in Prabhupada's translation here, is an inexorable flow, non-stoppable flow, or apratiyata. There's no obstacle that can stop the flow of pure devotion. The flow of pure devotion will overwhelm the obstacle. Then another nice point is that having to do with Vaishnava relationships, but they feel connected. So it's just, they feel part of the family of Krishna. And so here in the material world, there may be some harassment, problem, difficulty, something. And besides, maybe their flow of devotional service is unstoppable. And they don't become resentful of some bad treatment or something. But they're very strongly identifying themselves with Krishna's eternal associates. Krishna and Krishna's eternal associates. There, in the spiritual world, there is such a transcendental family. Like we hear of the Yadu dynasty. Krishna had, there are so many members of the Yadu dynasty that just, there's a figure found in Srimad Bhagavatam. There were 32 million teachers in their school. Must have had a lot of children. And that's just the children in the school, school-age children. Huge numbers. And that's just the Yadu dynasty. It's not the spiritual world. Just those that came to take part in Krishna's pastimes in this world. So there's a huge network of devotees. And in Goloka Vrindavan, they're all centered on Krishna. Whether it's the gopas or the gopis or the cows or the all the living entities there, they're just attached to Krishna. So this ties in, the reason I'm going over this is it ties into the subject in the ninth canto of I and Mine, and letting go of that and taking the spiritual conception. We're social beings and we want social interaction and affection and appreciation, and that's there on the spiritual platform. So, now what follows, the rest of chapter 8, it's one after another, after another, after another, after another. Questions, and I did spend some time looking, and at least in the beginning, the answers, which is the chapter title, answers, by citing the Lord's version, Shukadeva Goswami sequentially answers the questions. So it's at least it starts off, there's the first question, there's the second question, and he gives his replies in that order. So here's the first question. Here's the first three questions. Maharaj Pariksit wants to know, he's heard that the spirit soul is different from the body. So could you explain, please, how does acquiring the body take place? Is there a certain cause for the first body to be received, and how does it happen? Good question. Very good question. Then there's a few related questions to the next series, and that is the Supreme Lord. How is His body different than the bodies that we find here? For example, we find that the Supreme Lord, who has in His expansion as Garbho Dakshayi Vishnu, He has to produce the universes. So His body is big. And from His body, lotus grows from His navel, and on that lotus, Lord Brahma is born. And within the stem of the lotus, all the planets are arranged. So, but we also find that there are living entities within inhabiting those planets. They also have big bodies. Then some living entities have small bodies. So is there some correlation between the Lord's assuming this form of the Purusha avatars for the purpose of creation and the bodies of living entities? They also have something to do, and so they get an appropriate body. Is there a difference between them? If so, what is that difference? And then talk starts going into Lord Brahma, because he plays an important role in the ninth chapter. So what about the body of Lord Brahma? The body of Lord Brahma is born from the body of Garbho Dakshayi Vishnu without the help of a mother. So what's the difference between the body of the Supreme Lord and the body of Lord Brahma? Is Brahma's body also spiritual? What's the distinction? Then another question. Please explain how the Supreme Lord, as His Purusha Avatara, Shira Dakshay Vishnu, if He's all spiritual, He's not only in contact with material energy by glancing, He's also within the heart. Does He mix with the material energy? Then he starts asking some questions about the universal form, which was talked about earlier, the Virat Purusha. So he says, I've heard that the planets, they're all situated on this Virat Purusha, and then the systems of planets like Bhu Loka and Bhuvar Loka and Svar Loka, they're situated on the Virat Purusha. So I want to hear something more about that. How are they actually situated in the Virat Purusha? Good question. And now he wants to know more about creation. Actually, the chapter just goes on and on. Questions. He started numbering them. A lot of questions. About creation. And time. What's the duration of time between creation and annihilation? And for that matter, could you just explain time? Nice question. And there are measurements of life of living entities that inhabit the planets of creation, some of short duration, some of long duration. How does that work? Then what causes the different durations of time? Then how does karma work? Karma is the reaction accumulated over time for each living entity. And then, according to karma, the modes of nature act upon the living entity, and from the topmost creatures down to the lowest creatures in creation, this is going on. Can you explain that a little bit more? Time, karma, jiva, Ishwara, how does it all fit together, etc. So now we're going to jump ahead. And when Shukadeva Goswami, at the end, as the chapter closes, hears everything, he's very happy. He has a real good student. And so before he speaks, he glorifies, he appreciates the questioner. He glorifies the subject matter, Srimad Bhagavatam, and the person who he learned it from, Srimad Vyasadeva. And he begins speaking with the intention of satisfying all the questions of Vyasadeva, of Maharaj Pariksit. So what was the first question? The living entities and receiving a material body, and how did all that begin? So here is the answer. Text 1 of chapter 9. Shukadeva Goswami said, O King, unless one is influenced by the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there is no meaning to the relationship of the pure soul and pure consciousness with the material body. That relationship is just like a dreamer's seeing his own body working. That's his answer. So, how did it begin? Well, it's just a dream. And in the purport, Prabhupada specifically says, and this is one of the many places where he says it, that something to the effect that it's a waste of time. There is no necessity of tracing out the history of when the living entity desired this. This means independent enjoyment. But how it happened that the living entity gets a material body is that event, desiring independent enjoyment. And when that desire comes, then the illusory energy comes into play. The illusory energy, very nice description of this in the 10th canto. Just read this. Where Lord Krishna is speaking to his Yogamaya potency, and he's giving her instructions that she should transfer Baladev from the womb of Devaki to the womb of Rohini. And he anticipates that she is going to feel this is going to be very difficult to do, because Baladev is very heavy, because he's the source of everything. And so he blesses her that she'll be able to do it. And then he instructs that she should take birth herself as the daughter of Mother Yashoda. And then he explains that you will, the attempt will be to, made to kill you by Kamsa, which you won't be able to do. And then after that, you will be dispersed throughout all the lands and be worshipped by animal slaughter for persons who are very much desirous of the fulfillment of material desire. Which is strange, because he's speaking to Yogamaya, and then it's the same person he's addressing, and he addresses her as the material goddess Devi, or Durga, or Uma, or any of the other names that that daughter, when Kamsa tried to dash her to the ground, flew up into the sky with many arms and known by so many names, and then spoke to Kamsa. So it's explained at the end, that very, very long kind of addendum purport at the end of chapter 1, that it's one energy, actually one person, because the energy is a person, one person who manifests differently according to the living entity, according to the desire of the living entity. If the desire of the living entity is to connect with Krishna, Yogamaya is the agency that makes that connection. And Mahamaya is the agency that causes the living entity to be covered in forgetfulness. And a very nice explanation is given of the verse from Bhagavad Gita, Naham Prakasha Sarvasya. Mudho something. How's it end? Loko Mam Ajam Agyayam. Yeah. Remember it now, right? Okay, so question. Why is Yogamaya, this is one of these common Bhagavad Gita questions people like to ask. Or like it's kind of like a trick question, or easy to not understand it. Why is Yogamaya used here? Why is not Mahamaya used here? And the answer is given in that description, that Mahamaya is an expansion of Yogamaya. So when it says Yogamaya Samavrata, we should understand it's Yogamaya's expansion. Mahamaya. Because Mahamaya is perceived by those who have material desire. Krishna conceals himself by his Mahamaya, or his expansion of his Yogamaya potency, to block from our vision Krishna. As long as we have material desire, we won't see Krishna. We'll see Mahamaya. We'll see that facility which attracts us to try to enjoy separately. So the living entity becomes covered by that energy. And then the next verse describes the covering. The eye and mind sense of material consciousness. Then Prabhupada poses the question that always goes along with this question of how did it begin, is why does Krishna do that? And the language that he's using, he says he wills it, but he wills it because of his will is there to reciprocate with the will of the living entity. I want to enjoy apart from Krishna. You can't enjoy apart from Krishna. I want to enjoy apart from Krishna. It's not possible. Okay. Here's this illusory energy. Go try to enjoy apart from Krishna. You can't enjoy I once, okay. So it's a shadow energy covering the living entities.